the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Right, good. It's lovely to be with you. Chris is right. We're going to be looking at Elijah over three Sunday evenings. We're going to look at these stories from the book of 1 Kings. And each of the stories that we're going to consider over this period just gives us some real insight, I think, into the character of Elijah. But it's not just Elijah that we get to learn about, because I think we get to learn a lot about God as well. And so that, I hope, is our plan as we go through these stories. In thinking about this evening, I was reminded of the words that were attributed to Mary Slessor, one of the pioneering female missionaries of the 19th century. She said this: God and one are always a majority. Now, I think that's a wonderful statement that could sum up Elijah's life for us. God and one are always a majority. And as the stories unfold, we'll discover that Elijah is somebody who is absolutely refuses to be limited by people's expectations of him. He's someone who's prepared to move out of his comfort zone. He's someone who is prepared to follow God's plan for his life wherever it takes him. And he's someone who, because of that, accomplishes far more, I think, than ever could have been expected of him. He's a man that's so energized by God, and he has this amazing desire to remain faithful to him, even though at times he finds it really, really hard and really, really difficult. And as I said, I think the insights that we get are insights into Elijah's life, most certainly. But more than that, they help us as disciples today, and they also help us to understand God a little bit more. Now, I think because it's the start of the series, we do need to set this into some sort of historical framework. The bit that we read from the end of 16 is quite confusing when you read it to start with. You think, what's going on? Who? Where? There's an awful lot of names, a lot of different territories. So let's do a little bit of history. So all of the stories that we're going to read off come from the last third of the book of 1 Kings. And in majority, 1 Kings is the unfolding story of a monarchy that is in decline. The book opens with King David on the throne. King David is ruling over united Israel. He's ruling over a union of 12 tribes under one monarch. It's a nation that's forged together through a covenant relationship with Yahweh, with Jehovah, the one true God. However, after David's death, the line of succession passes on to Solomon, his son. And it's during Solomon's reign that things start to get a bit shaky. Cracks appear in the spiritual and the political life of the nation. And the next king, Rehoboam, Solomon's son, accelerates this decline by leading God's chosen people into partition. And that is what you get on that map that's on the screen. As a direct result of Rehoboam's repressive regime, 10 of the northernmost tribes form a rebel alliance. They elect Jeroboam, one of Solomon's legal advisors, to be their king. The nation splits into two kingdoms, Israel and Judah. Israel is in the north, Judah is in the south. And one of the results of this split is that the acknowledged spiritual heart of the nation, the capital city of the United Kingdom, the city of Jerusalem, is now lost to the northern kingdom. So Jeroboam sets up new centers for worship in Bethel and Dan. That's what we read about. And the catalogue of seeming unending descent into spiritual apathy just carries on. It's this constant theme of the book. It's a downward trend. It's the backdrop as well for the stories that we're about to read. Because the stories come during the reign of King Ahab, the 10th king of Israel. The scene is Samaria. The date is pretty much 865 BC. Samaria is the new capital of the northern kingdom. Remember, they've lost Jerusalem. It's a hilltop city. It owes its meteoric rise to importance and status because of this building program that Omri, who was Ahab's father, put into place. But it's not all about building, Because in fact, that's not the story of 1 Kings, really. It's not about building, it's about dismantling. Because what happens is slowly the spiritual, the worship life of God and the sanctioning of the worship of false gods such as Baal take center stage. Look again at what we read. This is what it said at the close of chapter 16. He, that is Ahab, set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal that he built in Samaria. Now, in part, as we read, if you noticed it clearly, Ahab's inclusion of Baal worship comes by way of his alliance with Sidon. He's decided for political, military, and all sorts of reasons that it's best to get into bed, quite literally, as it turns out, with his neighbor. And he seals this alliance through his marriage to a Sidonian princess, Jezebel. And Baal worship wasn't exclusively Sidonian, in fact. Its influence was widespread throughout the Middle East. But if you know your history when it comes to the people of Israel, you'll know that the dabbling with idolatry doesn't start here. They've already had a go in a variety of ways. And Moses warned the people not to do it. As Moses and all the people stood on the banks of the Jordan as they were just about to go into the promised land, this is what Moses said. He said this: "Do not follow other gods, the gods of the people around you. For the Lord your God, who is among you, is a jealous God, and his anger will burn against you. He will destroy you from the face of the land." But as it turns out, no amount of fiery rhetoric from their leader was sufficient to stop them from attaching themselves to all kinds of spiritual and cultural identities that they found amongst the people that they started to knock around with. And the reason that they find themselves worshipping Baal or Baal is simple. Baal worship is really attractive. It's great. It appeals to human nature. You see, what you do is you bring your sacrifice to the gods, and in return, you believe that the gods will look after you. So Baal worship flatters human vanity. The larger the gift, the louder you shout, the more you worship, the more impressive you are to the people around you and to, you suppose, the God that you're worshipping. So worship of Baal was a materialistic bargain. It pandered to pride. It panders to self-centered, thrill-seeking, sensual nature's people. It was also a fertility cult. It encouraged people towards immorality, sexual desensification through the availability of shrine prostitutes. Worship took on a whole new aspect. You see, worship became all about me and not about God. Worship became everything that was inward and nothing that was upward. This was the cult of self-satisfaction. Interesting. Sound familiar? It sounds very, very modern to me. It sounds almost like what we see around us. And we would love to think, wouldn't we, that we are immune from such modern day Baal equivalents. But I'm not so sure. And so at the moment of national crisis, moment of clear spiritual and moral collapse, we discover that God chose to speak to one man. He chose to make his voice heard. And he does it through Elijah. Now, Elijah comes from Tishbe in Gilead. He's kind of over the river. He's kind of a sort of backwoodsman, in fact. He lives nowhere. He really is in the back of beyond. This is not a sophisticated city dweller. But he's the man who God chooses to challenge the king. And in fact, Elijah's name on its own is a challenge. Because Elijah's name means the real God is Yahweh or Jehovah. So here is an ordinary person, as James writes in his letter, a person just like you and I, being called to do something extraordinary. So the first time that we hear of Elijah is at the beginning of 1 Kings chapter 17. If you've got it in front of you, his words are to the king. He travels then from Gilead across and into Samaria. They're very direct, they're very brief. It's almost, it appears, like a shout on the run. It's like a sort of a verbal javelin that he throws into the presence of the king. As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve, there will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years except at my words. So Elijah's first prophetic utterance as God's prophet is one sentence long. It takes up one verse in our Bibles, but these few words are to have a devastating effect upon the nation of Israel. And they set into motion a whole series of events that will eventually and ultimately lead to a very public display of God's power and might on top of Mount Carmel, which is what we'll think about next week with Rachel's help. I want us to notice five things very briefly then from this passage. They all start with P. That's not the important thing. That's just there to perhaps help us to remember them. We're going to think about God's person, his purpose. We're going to think about God's promise, his plan, and his provision. Firstly then, I want us to consider that Elijah is completely convinced of God's reality, of his person. Elijah goes and he confronts the king with this inescapable fact that whilst he as king may wish to ignore God, that he as king may wish to replace God with the worship of Baal, that does nothing to alter the fact that Jehovah, the God of Israel, is the only one true and living God. Such a statement, of course, remains true today. The fact of God's existence is in no way affected by humankind's denial of it. We may wish to deny it. Many people wish to deny it. But the fact of God's existence isn't in any way affected by that denial. In the original Hebrew, the word living is the first word that Elijah speaks. The first word that he says is living. The second word he says is God. And the two words grammatically in the sentence that he gives here are linked in such a way that they cannot be separated. So he says living God is his starting point. Those two things are together. You see, for Elijah, God is no mere theoretical or theological ideal, but a living and personal God. God, to Elijah, is understandable. He's knowable. He's something that he can have a relationship, someone that he can share a relationship. And God is revealed by the stories that we're going to share. And the reason why we've named the story the God of Elijah is because this is a personal story. This is a story where Elijah and God are intertwined, where you cannot separate the two. But it's not just that Elijah is convinced of the reality of God's person. He's also convinced that God has an agenda, that God has a purpose. He's convinced that it's a purpose that's not only for his life, but it's for the life of the nation. And that's why, if you look early on, that Elijah chooses to remind the king of the covenant relationship that was set up when the nation was birthed. So God's promise was to watch over his chosen people. And that promise, of course, was linked to the preparedness of the people to be faithful and obedient. It was a contract. It was a promise bargain. It was a covenant. So when the people gathered at the foot of Mount Sinai, before Moses went up and received the Ten Commandments, this is what we find. Speaking God's word to the nation, he says this: if you obey me, that's if you obey God fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations, you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. I think it's interesting for Elijah that serving God isn't an option. It's not something, when I say an option, it's not something that you can choose from kind of a pick and mix selection. You remember those if you're old enough, where you used to be able to go through Woolworths and just pick the things you want and put them into a bag. This isn't a pick and mix spirituality here. Elijah's faithfulness to God is exclusive. He's seen what's going on. He knows what's going on in the nation around him. And he says, I'm having none of that because God is the true God. But it's not something that's required just of him. It's something that's required of the king. It's something that's required of the entire nation. But unfortunately, as someone has once commented in a letter to the Times newspaper, most people wish to serve God, but in an advisory capacity only. And I think sometimes we fall into that trap as well, don't we? But not so Elijah. He took God at his word, he steps out in faith, he responds to God's call, and God leads him straight to the palace of the king. I think that speaking out against injustice and swimming against the tide of public opinion is never easy. It's never an easy option. But this is what Elijah does. But the truth is, and you discover this if you plunge into a fast-flowing stream, any activity in fast-flowing water results in an inevitable steady drift downstream. God doesn't give Elijah sort of the option to tread water. Instead, he convinces Elijah that he's alive, he's imminent, that he must be obeyed, and that he can be trusted. And so it is that Elijah from Tishbe, the back of beyond, crosses the Jordan, wanders towards Samaria with this message for the king. And in the remainder of the verse, we have what is, I think, a remarkable promise from God. Although not the kind of promise, perhaps, that maybe we associate with God very often. Elijah says to the king, "There will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years except at my word." In effect, these words are a taunt. They're a taunt to the king. He's challenging about the legitimacy of the path that he has taken in terms of setting up the worship of Baal. You see, Baal was a fertility god. Okay then, let's see, shall we? How good is your god in a land that's not going to have any rain? In Sidonian culture, Baal is often pictured as a sun god. Okay, let's see, shall we? How do we get on as a nation with unrelenting sunshine? And these words from God actually aren't new ones. Back in Deuteronomy, in a section that talks about the result of following other gods, we get this. So this is a repeat. "He will shut the heavens," that is God, "so that it will not rain, and the ground will yield no produce, and you will soon perish from the good land the Lord is giving you." Have you ever noticed that time and time again, God's word isn't very comfortable? It doesn't make for comfortable reading. And so with it, God's words ringing in the ears of a no doubt furious, I would have thought, and quite indignant king, Elijah runs from the palace. He heads out into the wilderness and into exile. Now, we're not going to, if you're worried about time, we're not going to spend, we're not going to look at the whole passage. I know Andrew's going to touch on the last bit. We're going to go and look through to verse 16, and I'm going to leave you to think about the final story from our reading. Now, at first glance, I think we could be excused for thinking that Elijah's journey eastward across the Jordan to go and hide in the Kerith Ravine sounds rather like he's running away. But I think close reading of the text shows that's not the case. Verse 2 says he goes in obedience to God's explicit instruction. So there's a reason. There's a reason why he runs into the palace, he gets in front of the king, he says one sentence, he leaves the king, he gets out of Samaria, he travels across the Jordan and sets up camp by the Kerith River. So there's a reason. I think in part it's a visual aid, actually. If you go through the stories of the prophets, they're really, really interesting. You find that actions always accompany words. Some of the actions are bizarre, I warn you, but they do accompany words in order to just emphasize what's going on. So you read about Jeremiah, for instance. He goes, buys a lot of pots and he smashes them on the ground. You read about Ezekiel. He does what is the sort of, however old it is, equivalent of Airfix kit. He goes and he makes little model towns. And then if you read about Micah, well, he walks around the town naked. And each of these actions comes as a response to the words. So they say God's words, and then they have an action to back them up, a visual key. And I think Elijah's disappearance is a similar dramatic device. What God's doing is withdrawing his prophet from the presence of the king. God is displeased with Ahab. Not only had Ahab's actions brought a physical drought upon the nation, he brought a spiritual drought before that. And that reality is being reinforced by God by taking his prophet and physically removing him from the sight of the king, in fact, over the border, back into Gilead. But this requirement to sort of live out the truth of God's revealed word isn't restricted to the job description of a prophet. Although I would suggest we probably best don't go down Micah's route. But there is different ways that we can choose to do it, isn't it? To live out life. You see, the thing is, if we fail to live by the truth we profess to believe, if word isn't reinforced by walk, then we fall into the trap of what we could call believism. It's that idea that intellectual adherence is all that's needed to a body of truth. But Elijah's story persuades us otherwise, doesn't he? He's prepared to act on his knowledge. He doesn't simply listen to God's word. He signals his availability. He demonstrates that word in his life. He lives the truth. So in his way, he is sharing the story and living the life. And Elijah, by following God's leading, enters into what turns out to be an intensive 3-year discipleship training course. He's off to university. That's where he's going. God's way of getting Elijah ready for the dramatic and uncompromising engagement with the prophets on top of Mount Carmel is to put him in the Kerith Ravine for 3 years, or almost. Now, if you were to ask Elijah, if you were to say, what do you think is going to happen after you've gone to see the king? I wonder what he would have said. He'd have probably thought, well, I'm sure there'll be plenty more words that God's going to have to say to me. And I'll be telling them to the people. Perhaps I'll be going around the whole nation, telling people what God has to say. But instead of that, that's not what happens at all, is it? Do you ever find that you're in a similar position? Our expectation of how God is going to work in our lives is nothing like the reality that we experience. It's nothing like it at all. Sometimes it's so wildly different that we can associate ourselves very much with the story of Elijah. And this section of the story reveals that God's plans are somewhat surprising. I'm sure he thought, won't I be saying more than just one sentence as the prophet? And why am I being called away from the palace, which is clearly the place of influence, to travel all this way across the Jordan, and as it happens, in fact, geographically, almost back home? He'd only have to walk up the Kerith Ravine and we'd be back in Tishbe. But no, God leaves him there in the wilderness. I am of the opinion, growing opinion, slowly, because I'm slow, that there is actually a big importance in spending time alone with God. Even if that looks to entail intents and purposes, as Johnny reminded us this morning, are the things that we all know about, but the things that we don't do. I think there is so much importance in doing that. We may expect it to be a dry wilderness encounter. And yet God calls us, I think, into these kinds of places at times. Don't think I'm very good at factoring those sorts of Kerith Ravine moments into my life, despite I think that I need them, but I don't do them. Why don't I do them? Why don't perhaps we do them? It's because they are very, very exposing. It's much easier to get on with stuff at times without thinking about it than to stop and ask God to speak into your life. The name Kereth means the place of cutting. Maybe it was for Elijah, a place where God chiseled away at some of the preconceptions that he had, chiseled away at some of the prejudice. This was a place of challenge. This is a place of pain. But allowing God the space and the time to shape our lives in such a way is, I think, necessary if we truly have this desire to be used by God to grow his kingdom. I've quoted this a few times. I make no apologies for quoting it again. Back in the 60s, J.B. Phillips wrote a book entitled Your God is Too Small. And mostly, Phillips' point is that people paint a sort of a caricature of God. They limit him. They have this sort of distorted misrepresentation that's not even close to God. We limit God by our imagination. We try to categorize and systemize. We try to dissect. We try to pull God down to our level. We try to box him in so that we can understand him. And we have, in my view at least, lost something vital. You see, there is a sense of unknowable wonder and fear and reverence that ought to be part and parcel of our worship of God. Phillips writes, if you can't believe in God, the chances are your God is too small. And then one of Phillips's contemporaries goes a step further, I think. This is what Tozer says in his book, The Knowledge of the Holy. What comes to our mind when we think of God is the most important thing about us. And since what we believe about God is so vital, we must constantly be on our guard against worshipping a God that is smaller than the true God, because doing so is the essence of idolatry. Now, if by living by the ravine wasn't surprising enough, God, when the brook eventually dries up, directs Elijah north to go and live in Zarephath, a place that was not only in the territory of Sidon, that's the place where Baal worship came from, but also it's the place where all of the problems started. The name Zarephath is interesting as well. He moves from the place of cutting to the place of testing. It's almost as if Elijah in his discipleship course, has been put out on a training placement. He's moving from this place of learning by the Kereth to the place where he has to put everything that he's learned into practice. This is his training placement. What he learns in solitude, he was being called to put into practice in this small and very needy community. This is a place where God's name, as in Jehovah's name, was neither spoken nor worshipped. And yet this is a place where God is going to show his power, but only if the prophet is willing to be led. I think God's provision in both of these stories is remarkable. And I think the stories serve to remind us that ultimately God is the one who is the source of all that we have. Look at this. This is what we read. From verse 4, we said, God said to Elijah, you will drink from the brook, and I have instructed the ravens to supply you with food. Then in verse 9, we read, I have instructed a widow to supply food. Now, both of these provisions are basic. They're basic in their scope. They're rather surprising in their source. And Elijah's experience beside the brook, well, could most definitely be seen as an austerity diet. But it wasn't actually a starvation one, was it? But God saw to it that Elijah had enough to eat. Two plain but adequate meals a day. And I don't think we are called to read into Elijah's story any claim that we should deny ourselves the thing we enjoy. We aren't called to be ascetics. But I think what we can read into the story is somewhat of a consumer check. Because we live in a materialistic, excessive society. And it's a society that is actually portraying the fact that excess is normal and that it's the basic right of all of us. But learning to be content with enough remains, I think, a really important principle for living. And the source of the provision is most definitely unexpected. God chooses this, it's, oh, I don't know what you would call it, it's a Meals on Wings service, isn't it, really, I guess. And it's important to remember, right from the start, that a raven is an unclean bird. In Jewish law, the law declares that no Israelite could eat a raven, since raven was a carrion bird. It fed off the dead flesh of other animals. And yet, despite that fact, God chooses this particular kind of bird to bring the food. And now I think there's a lesson there which we can miss because we just read over it. We think it's probably not that important. But I think there is a lesson there. Notice Elijah isn't actually asked to break the food laws. He doesn't kill and eat the raven. That would be pretty stupid given the circumstances, of course. But what he does is he takes the food from it. And I think what Elijah has been asked to do is to ensure that he forms the right perspectives. He's been asked to deal with, I think, some of his prejudices. He's been asked to recognize that God is much bigger than merely the law. I think he's been asked to deal with those things in his life. He's then asked to obey and be willing. And if he doesn't learn these things, if he doesn't allow his prejudices to be removed, if he doesn't allow for the fact that his perspectives need to be changed, he is going to be useless when he moves into his ministry placement. Because those are the very things that are tested the most when he gets to Zarephath. I think the ravens are God's way of gently leading Elijah towards what's coming next. Sometimes, I think the wilderness is God's way of preparing us for something that's coming next. We learn in solitude often the things that we need to put into place in the next thing that God has called us to do. So in Zarephath, he finds himself in a foreign country. It's full of foreign people. It's a place where most Israelites would assume that God would have no jurisdiction. He was outside of God's sphere of activity. He's going to live in the house of a widowed woman. This is a woman whose status would have been zero. Community really would count her as being a nobody. Even, of course, the people of Israel, the Jewish people, actually had a far better welfare state than the nations around them. He was going to live in that house, and you can imagine what kind of suspicion that would be, moving into the house of a widow. Yet it's into this situation that God reveals his power. Everything about that would speak of being in the wrong place. But he's in the right place. He's in the right place. There's such a serious situation, isn't there? This is what it says. The widow says, I am gathering a few sticks to take home and make a meal for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die. In a few moments, we're going to be sharing communion together, and spiritually speaking, that is exactly where we are. We're in the same situation. We have nothing in and of ourselves to prevent spiritual death. It's only through God's powerful intervention, through God's ultimate prophet, his son, the Lord Jesus Christ, that we know a provision that not only brings life, but nurtures life, encourages life, brings growth, brings increase over and over again. There's much more we can learn from the story, but we're going to leave it there, I think. And the remarkable truth of the story is that the God of Elijah is our God. That's the remarkable truth. And we have one massive advantage over Elijah, and it's the verse that I just erroneously put up for you, but there it is again. Writer to the Hebrews says this, in the past, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at many times in various ways, but in this last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, who he appointed heir of all things, and through whom also he made the universe. Something we will remember as we share communion a bit later. Elijah's God is our God, and we are called to serve and to worship him in our day-to-day living.